FISA, there are a couple of amendments that are being considered. One of them would require a warrant for every query of lawfully collected data. If that were to pass and get into the bill, would the president veto that bill?
We do not believe that that serves the national security interest of the United States. The warrant requirement, from our perspective, would go too far in undermining the very purpose of FISA, and frankly, it would put victims at risk.
Biden regime NSA stooge Jake Sullivan wants you to know, America, that the Reforming Intelligence and Securing America Act ensures that the intelligence community has the tools that it needs to identify and disrupt threats to the American people from hostile nation states, terrorist organizations, hackers, spies, and more, end quote. You know, the people the Biden regime led into the country by the millions.
According to the Wall Street Journal, the FBI, Department of Defense, and others have been conducting a year-long investigation into so-called gate crashers. It's happening all over the U.S., according to the report.
Section 702 continued to tighten its grip, choking the life out of the Bill of Rights of American citizens.
Where are those transmissions you intercepted? What have you done with those plans?
We intercepted no transmissions.
The legislation coming from the other body gives the government unchecked authority to order Americans to spy on behalf of their government. This was slipped in, Mr. President, in the last minutes in the House of Representatives bill, and this is the first time this language has ever been considered here in the United States Senate. Under current law, Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the government can order the phone companies and email and internet service providers to hand over communications. This bill expands that existing power dramatically. It says, and I quote, the government can force cooperation from, quote, any other service provider who has access to equipment that is being or may be used to transmit or store wire or electronic communications. So think for a moment about the millions of Americans who work in buildings and offices in which communications are stored or passed through. After all, every office building in America has data cables running through it. And the people are not just the engineers who install, maintain, and repair our communications infrastructure. There are countless others who could be forced to help the government spy, including those who clean offices and guard buildings. If this provision is enacted, the government can deputize any of these people against their will and force them, in effect, to become what amounts to an agent for Big Brother.
So, Director Ray, does the FBI currently comply in every way with the current Section 702 of FISA?
My understanding is that we're in compliance with the law.
Okay, so you think you do. All right, how do you respond to an unsealed document released by the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court on May 19th, 2023, which states your agency, the FBI, illegally misused this tool more than 278,000 times between 2020 and early 2021, and is this number of 278,000 abuses accurate?
Representative Andy Biggs attempted to impose a requirement for the FBI to obtain a warrant, but that ended in a tie vote and a full display of uniparty rule. Speaker Mike Johnson cast the tie-breaking vote against the amendment.
We have to know who the enemy is and what we have to do. And if it is a police state on our doorstep, we're already stepping in. I'll tell you what, we better wake up and respond to it.
We have learned is that the IRS, in fact, has been using AI to access bank accounts of American citizens without any kind of a search warrant or even without any specific claim that they have committed a crime. So this was something that was discovered by an undercover journalist. And what they found is that the IRS has claimed that they have access to every single person's bank account. This person also indicated that they've been working with the Department of Justice and that they have absolutely no problem whatsoever going after the little guy to make sure that they are paying their taxes.
John Bound reporting for InfoWars.
Hi, welcome to American Journal. My name is Lauren, or L, and I'm filling in for Harrison Smith today. I have popped in on the show a few times before. But if you don't know me, I am a former financial data analyst turned internet grifter. I'm happy to be here. I host a show of my own called Big Dig Energy. It comes on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday nights at 9 p.m. Central. To introduce myself just a little bit more, if you don't know me, up until about 2018, I was a devout liberal slash lefty. And the past 4 years or so of my life have pretty much upended everything that I ever knew. And I feel like a lot of people have that in common. So I'd like to share that little bit about myself because you're not alone. I gained a platform essentially on accident, and I've spent most of my time dissecting narratives, trying to find root causes and identify solutions or places to apply leverage in order to actually achieve something rather than just complain about it. So far, kind of minimal success, but you know, hey, there's no bad ideas in brainstorming time, right? I'm fully aware that you, as the average American Journal / InfoWars viewer, is likely significantly more knowledgeable on subjects than I am. So I stand / I guess really sit before you now to share a few topics with you that have largely escaped the current news cycle, but have been going on, you know, parallel to everything else in the 24-hour media cycle. And then plan to open up the phone lines to you in the latter half of the show so that we can talk about some things. I can get some input and maybe we can learn some things together. One final disclaimer, my own show tends to be a little bit more interactive because I do have a chat. So I promise to do my best to stay on topic and to not ramble too much, but this is a little bit different for me, but I'm thrilled to be here and so happy that they asked me to do it. So let's get into it, shall we? With that whole preamble, the level of trust in the country, in institutions, politics, communities, and even each other has eroded so rapidly over the last few years. And of course, we all know that when social trust collapses, that's when nations crumble. And the big question that people tend to ask is it too late to turn the ship around? And perhaps it's my own story that I lived out not too long ago. But I, for one, vehemently think so. We are up against a many-headed hydra that seems to pop up in every single place with, you know, suspiciously similar narratives, regardless of where you look to. That's not on accident. And it's undoubtedly intimidating. But the one thing that socio-political elites and the globalists have working against them is working against them on overtime. And it is that young people are not just gobbling up everything they say hook, line, and sinker. And you might be rolling your eyes at me right now because you look at the current state of things and you go, yeah, well, young people right now don't seem to have a good grasp on the world. And no, you are right. I think that it is a little bit unreasonable to expect the very product of the K-12, then university machine, to come out on the other side of it unscathed. It is working exactly as intended. However, for myself personally, as my frontal lobe finished developing and I became essentially sentient for the first time in my later 20s, the subsequent undoing of my emotionally charged and largely very ignorant college mindset was rapid and it was irreversible. Once you see it, you cannot unsee it. And at any given point, Gen Z and millennials in particular, not to count you out, Gen X and boomers, but just, you know, the youths of the world, are noticing these little cracks in the media narratives and the government facade. And once those little cracks start forming, it opens up a whole legion of possibilities otherwise. They've been told their entire lives by their K-12 teachers, their TV shows, and then ultimately their college professors and the Democratic Party, statistically speaking, that climate change has gone past the point of no return and that they can't afford a family or a home, and the promise of a stable home life repeatedly dangled in front of them and subsequently ripped away. And by seeking to be the ones who tell them there is more purpose out there and of meeting more than just your basic needs, but of self-actualization and fulfillment and community building in the real sense and not in the false sense, I truly don't see how we could possibly lose. So I wanted to highlight with you today a few stories from the past few days where I noticed the cracks in the facade, and I think that it would have been particularly effective with me when I was coming out of my stupor. And so first up for you, I have a feel-good story from the New York Post. This is from just this morning, an article about Adam Schiff, went to a fundraising event in San Francisco. And he, his luggage was, his car was broken into and his luggage was stolen. Kenneth Garger writes for the New York Post, California Representative Adam Schiff found out firsthand about San Francisco crime when his luggage was swiped from his car in a parking garage Thursday, being yesterday, forcing him to attend a fancy dinner in casual wear, according to a report. The Democrat, who is also running to replace the late Senator Dianne Feinstein's seat in the Senate, was in the city for a few days and had parked his car in a downtown garage before gathering with supporters. There's then a lovely photo of him standing amongst a table of people in suits and lovely clothes. And he says, yes, they took my bags. He confirmed this to the San Francisco Chronicle. But I'm here to thank Joe. And he's referring to a very high profile lawyer named Joe Cotchett, who is backing his Senate bid. And yes, in case you didn't know, or in case you had blissfully forgotten about Adam Schiff for a while, he is running for a Senate seat to replace Dianne Feinstein, and he announced this back in January of 2023. He is going to face off with Republican candidate Steve Garvey on November 5th in the general election, as they both claimed their primary seat last month on March 5th. Joe Cotchett, who's the man who Schiff came to meet yesterday in San Francisco, contributed the maximum amount to his primary campaign, according to the FEC data, which is a total of about $3,300. And I assume there's more through various organizations, but I think the single contribution limit, I could be wrong on this, is $3,300. So it doesn't sound like much, but it also comes from elsewhere. He makes up the Cotchett of Cotchett, Peter, and McCarthy LLP, which has operated for over a half a century and engages, quote, exclusively in litigation and trials. Schiff has been raising eye-watering amounts of money, though, for his seat in the Senate, and it totals over $35 million so far for a Senate seat, hotly contested. And so in preparation for the general election this fall, compared to what PACs have been raising on his behalf, Cotchett's donations are almost nothing. And of course, this has been the hot topic over the last, well, really 6 months or so. But an organization called AIPAC has caught a lot of people's attention, and not necessarily in a good way. In a March 6th article in the media from Haaretz, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, I'm from Alabama, that's my right. They published an article titled AIPAC Super PAC Set to Lose First Race of 2024 Despite Record Spending, but reveals a major win. And they revealed a major win last March, or this past March, a month ago, to be Adam Schiff's primary victory. Quote, the Super PAC spent $4.6 million in attack ads against the congressional candidate Dave Minn, a Democrat from California who is poised to win the seat. They later revealed that they also gave $5 million to the Super PAC of Senate candidate Adam Schiff, who claimed a victory. $5 million from AIPAC to Adam Schiff alone. We're going to get a little bit more into what AIPAC is. I'm sure you're very familiar with it, but for anyone who needs a quick little rundown, we'll get there in just a second. On the Federal Election Commission website for fiscal year 2023 to 2024, covering these election seasons, so far, AIPAC is on the books for about $31,800,000 and some change, 4 cents, in fact, in total federal receipts. So, of that amount that they have recorded on the FEC's website, Adam Schiff accounts for about a sixth of it for one Senate seat alone. They seem to really, really want him in there. The only disclaimer I can leave you with here is that there's often a gap in between money being spent and being reported on the FEC site as an eye-watering amount of money on the FEC site. So that number might be significantly different for too long. But as of right now, 1/6 of the total spending of AIPAC goes to Adam Schiff. I have a quick little video for you here if you're not familiar with what AIPAC is. This is their narrative. This is what they have on their YouTube. The title of the YouTube video is Our Work to Strengthen the U.S.-Israel Relationship. And I think it's how they want to be perceived. And then obviously there's that, and then there's how I think the rest of us tend to take them in. So sorry, I'm kind of stalling. Do you see the video link?
For decades, AIPAC has brought Democrats and Republicans together to strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship. Passionate Americans have lobbied Congress to enact pro-Israel policies, and today, the alliance is closer than ever, and we aren't done. We have a vision for an even stronger U.S.-Israel relationship, ensuring Israel can always defend itself by itself, collaborating in the fields that will define the 21st century, and working together for peace and stability. The majority of Americans share our vision, and the majority of Congress is pro-Israel, but a new threat is on the rise. Small in numbers, but loud in reach, anti-Israel members of Congress are trying to destroy our partnership with Israel.
Israel has violated basic human rights.
We must condition aid to Israel and end the apartheid.
They are willing to tank their own party's agenda to block funding for Iron Dome, and they're not done. They're running anti-Israel candidates across the country, trying to grow their squad. And so, we must grow stronger. AIPAC has launched a new political strategy that requires a dramatic increase in resources to be successful. We support pro-Israel candidates for Congress and defeat anti-Israel candidates. And so far, our strategy is working. In this election cycle, AIPAC members have changed the course of campaigns. We have given pro-Israel candidates the resources they need to win. We launched a super PAC, taking the political fight to those who work to undermine the U.S.-Israel relationship. Because of our work, more pro-Israel candidates won. More anti-Israel candidates lost.
I want to thank AIPAC in particular.
Thank you, AIPAC. Thanks for AIPAC for everything that you continue to do.
In an uncertain world, we understand what is at stake. Together, we are ensuring the U.S.-Israel relationship remains strong. Together, we are working to keep Congress pro-Israel. But our fight is not over. And our work has just begun.
Wasn't that inspiring? Now, as someone who did recently become sentient about 4 or 5 years ago now, I don't claim to have all the right or wrong answers on issues in Israel and Gaza. However, I do know that the list of, I've scrolled away from where I was supposed to be at. I do know that the list of key issues that AIPAC lists on their site, there's 6 key issues, in fact, tend to involve the United States sending boatloads of cash overseas, not asking questions if they, if we have any, and anything or anyone who questions anything about it being smeared as an anti-Semite immediately. You know the drill. It's a pretty formulaic thing, and it's very effective. People are terrified of it. On the AIPAC site, they list their 6 key issues as 1, strengthening the United States and Israel relationship, 2, supporting security assistance to Israel, 3, promoting peace, 4, countering Iran's aggression and nuclear weapons quest, 5, I don't know if I can count here, combating terrorism, and then of course 6, the one that I just mentioned, the one that's the most effective, is opposing anti-Israel discrimination. Depending on who you ask, which organization or which individual in particular, that can mean simply not denying someone a job because they're Jewish, or it can mean saying something that is then called a dog whistle and then you getting canceled, and everywhere in between, obviously. On the AIPAC PAC site, the group states, quote, "Being pro-Israel is good policy and good politics." It then expands to a 3-page PDF that lists all of their accolades, which are honestly pretty mind-blowing. And I didn't know any of this until just a few days ago myself. So I wanted to lay this out for you here. Under the previous claim where it says being pro-Israel is good policy and good politics, it says that AIPAC and our 2.7 million members work to strengthen and expand the U.S.-Israel relationship on a bipartisan basis. The AIPAC PAC was founded in December of 2021. The actual organization itself has existed for many decades longer. And again, started pushing lots of funding in politics. So again, it was founded in December of 2021 to support pro-Israel candidates and members of Congress. And in just 1 year, since it's beginning to dabble into PAC money, AIPAC claims that they delivered more money directly to candidates than any other PAC in America. They claim to have endorsed 365 candidates over the course of the election cycle, and over 98% of the AIPAC PAC endorsed candidates won their general election races in the election year of 2022. I also do have a cat, and she might be coming to say hello to you because she thinks you're super duper great. It then goes down on this PDF, and it's They said that they endorsed the majority of House Democrats and Republicans in 2022. They endorsed 365 members of candidates for Congress, and they were proud to support 100% of the Democrat and Republican leadership teams. More than $17.5 million was directly distributed to candidates. Contributions from AIPAC PAC and AIPAC members through the PAC delivered more than $17.5 million to pro-Israel candidates running for Congress. Everyday Americans, they then claim, support a strong U.S.-Israel relationship, and more than 6,000 pro-Israel Americans supported pro-Israel candidates via the AIPAC PAC. They continue to support pro-Israel candidates running against anti-Israel candidates. And they helped propel campaigns of 13 candidates who were taking on directly anti-Israel challengers with significant hard dollar contributions to their campaigns. For example, I think looking in fiscal year 2024 for the 2024 general election, you have, again, $5 million, was it six, going directly to Adam Schiff's Senate campaign. 1/6 of the total dollars so far. They also list a couple of other progressive caucuses that they're involved with. AIPAC PAC distributed more to progressive caucus members than in J Street, Justice Democrats, and Emily's List combined, it says. More than $2.5 million in support was distributed to Black caucus members through the AIPAC PAC. AIPAC PAC was the largest conduit contributor to current and prospective Hispanic caucus members. And AIPAC PAC supported 89% of members of the Republican Study Committee. Down on the second page here, they say AIPAC has long been a bipartisan organization, and its entry this year into direct political spending has included giving to both Democrats and Republicans. When they need to garner support, they can do it immediately. 365 candidates they endorsed. And on the third page down there at the bottom, you have a lovely little graph where they say, again, being pro-Israel is good policy and good politics. And they show 17.5 distributed to candidates. The second below that in PAC money is Emily's List with 8.7 million, J Street with 6.5, Club for Growth 4.4, the League of Conservation Voters with 1.2, a little bit under a million is the End Citizens United, and Justice Democrats with 71,000. So almost double the second runner up in PAC money, which is pretty wild. And so going back to the amount that they've raised so far for the 2024 election year, which, again, there's still going to be significantly more coming in for the general election, they have $31,820,211.04 in total federal receipts so far. When I said eye-watering earlier, I meant it. Sorry, one sec. I lost my place, and this is the part where I would rabble-rouse on my show. I'm sorry. MSNBC put out a lovely video in December of last year explaining how they were the top 20 spender in the 2022 election. And it's honestly one of the better overviews. It's Ari Velshi, I hope I said his name correctly, who gives the rundown. It's about 3.5 minutes long. And I guess we'll have to get to that one when we come back. But what we're going to watch when we come back is the talking about AIPAC taking a very sharp turn in 2021 when it began endorsing candidates directly and then dumping their money in. And now it's the top spender in politics. And in fact, last year in December as well, right around when this video came out, there's one Democrat lawmaker who went on the record as saying that backing Israel is the path of least resistance because AIPAC come to his office at least once a month to make his life just living heck if he doesn't go along with their policies and demands. And they said that most of Congress is reflexively anti-Palestinian because there is nobody telling their story. So keeping all of this in mind, I think that going back to the overall theme of there being cracks in narratives, ordinarily, I don't think people would be looking as critically as they are currently at the Israel-Palestine conflict. And again, I don't claim to have all the right answers, but I do know that even 20 years ago, in a post-9/11 world, we just, you know, they said we're... I was 11 years old, and I wanted to nuke Afghanistan. Whatever George Bush said, I went along with it, right? And I think a lot of us did because we didn't know any better. But there is a beast that's been unleashed with the power to share information and, you know, get around their censorship and their anti-disinformation, quote-unquote, campaigns. And it's unstoppable. So when you think about various instances in which young people of the world feel hopeless, I just don't, this one's such a big one, and they're honestly terrified of it. So when we come back, we're going to watch that video from MSNBC, and we're going to keep discussing this, and then we're going to get into geothermal engineering via Bill Gates, which is pretty fun. So I'll see you in just a little bit, and thanks for watching so far. Thanks for putting up with me through that first segment. I'm feeling a little bit more in charge here. And so where we left off last time, discussing essentially how I just quite simply think that we're at an inflection point with particularly young voters who maybe are not necessarily going to come all the way over to your side, but I think are more willing to hear, I guess, the other side of the aisle out, because their side, as we all know, is a death cult who tells them that they're going to own nothing and be happy, that they're never going to be able to own a home, start a family, that, you know, everything is racist, everything is harkens back to the original sins of the United States, and that nothing can ever truly just be enjoyable, that we're past the point of no return on climate change. And it's given a lot of young people a very bleak outlook. And as someone who used to have one of those very bleak outlooks, I resonate with that really well. So happy Friday. We started off with Adam Schiff, who had his car broken into yesterday on his way to a fundraiser meeting for his Senate campaign. He is running for the Senate seat to replace Dianne Feinstein, who, as you all know, on the day she died last year, they dragged her butt in to raise her hand one last time, which is just unbelievable. So his car was broken into in San Francisco, which, as someone who used to live in that area briefly, you don't drive your car and park it in downtown San Francisco, and you certainly don't leave anything in it. But he did. And they made jokes about it, about going to go buy a new suit with Willie Brown, which is laughable on a lot of different levels. But then we started to get into, they were kind of touting this lawyer as a high profile big spender. And I started to look into Adam Schiff's actual election funding and found that everyone's favorite organization to hate right now, it seems, or at least for the most part, AIPAC has spent 1/6 of their total federal election budget for the year so far, listed on the FEC's website, seemingly on getting Adam Schiff elected to that Senate seat. So now I wanted to show you a video that MSNBC last year in December, and the description of it is essentially explaining how AIPAC went from being an apolitical, no money spending entity to, in 2021, when it came in like a wrecking ball, to quote Miley Cyrus, and began endorsing candidates and contributing direct funds to their campaigns. And since then, it has become a top spender in politics, contributing to the campaigns of 342 Congress members so far as of December of last year. So it's just a few minutes long, and I know it's MSNBC, but I truly do think that it's a good overview if you're not familiar with how it all works. So let's watch together, and I'll see you in just a second.
Talk about AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It was incorporated in 1963. For 10 years prior to that, it was known as the American Zionist Committee for Public Affairs. AIPAC calls itself America's pro-Israel lobby, and according to its website, it has over 3 million members across the country in regional chapters working to, quote, expand and strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship, end quote. You may know AIPAC as being one of the biggest and most recognizable donors to many of the members of Congress in your state. But contributing to campaigns is a relatively new function of the organization. Before 2021, AIPAC did not endorse candidates nor give political contributions. Its focus was on lobbying elected officials, not actually electing officials. But in a dramatic shift in policy, AIPAC began directly funding candidates and spending big on races in 2021. AIPAC Political Action Committee, AIPAC PAC, filed something called a Statement of Organization with the FEC just in time for the 2022 election cycle, where it spent $50 million, including both direct contributions to candidates and outside spending like TV advertisements. According to AIPAC, it donated money to 365 candidates from both parties, including every single member of both Democratic and Republican leadership in Congress. 109 Republicans who voted against the certification of the 2020 presidential election in America received campaign contributions from AIPAC. All in all, AIPAC gave money to 342 members of the 118th Congress. The 2022 elections were the most expensive midterms in American history, with a total cost of $8.9 billion spent. Now, last year, AIPAC ranked 15th in total expenditure by a political action committee, according to data collected by Open Secrets. But take a look at the other funders that AIPAC is competing against for that title. Act Blue and Win Red. They are Democratic and Republican Party machines. Save America is Donald Trump's money-raising operation. The Conservative Club for Growth, Emily's List, focuses on electing Democratic women to office. All of the PACs on this list are massively domestic-focused ideological machines. AIPAC is the only organization in the top 20 whose interests are focused entirely on America's relationship to a foreign government. Now, let's take a look at who benefits from AIPAC's largesse. Here are the top 20 recipients in Congress, the House and the Senate, of AIPAC money in the 2022 midterm cycle, according to Open Secrets. They're members of both parties. They come from every corner of the country with varying levels of experience in Congress. The Democrat Glenn Ivey of Maryland tops the list. He beat out fellow Democrat Donna Edwards in Maryland's House primary after AIPAC poured millions into pro-Ivey advertisements and mailers. Edwards was running for a second stint in Congress after serving during the Obama administration, where she voted present, not even a no, on a number of pro-Israel resolutions. So the money poured in against her. Not even an endorsement from Nancy Pelosi could save her. Michigan Democrat Haley Stevens unseated Democratic Representative Andy Levin. Here's what Levin had to say about that.
So it goes on for a little bit longer than that, but that was, I thought, the most pertinent to it. So again, this is a massive political force that has not been anything up until 3 years ago. And it's very obvious when you have a single entity where he said even Nancy Pelosi couldn't save a specific candidate because of they were just outspent, outmatched, and their chosen candidate of choice was lauded and their opponent just smeared into the ground until they lose. They boast a very high success rate. And when they say on their site and on all of their pages that being pro-Israel is good policy and good politics, what they mean is if you want to have a seat at the table in the House or the Senate in the federal government now, you have to play along. And what's interesting about this is that last year, a senior House Democrat went on the record and said that most members of Congress are simply reflexively anti-Palestinian because there is nobody telling their story, and that the pro-Israel lobbyists have much more influence and presence, specifically on Capitol Hill, and it's the path of least resistance. And I don't know about you, but as someone who I don't know what I thought the government was capable. Or, you know, if you got elected to Congress or the Senate, you know, you could change the world. I don't know really why I was that delusional. But when you have entire swaths, when you have 360 some odd people who have received funding from this organization, and then you have others going on the record and saying it's the path of least resistance, you can see how easily we can be led down a path that seemingly nobody has an interest in, regardless of whether you stand more on the side of the Palestinians or of Israel. I can't think of any American who's just gung-ho for war, except for maybe Nikki Haley, live, laugh, Lockheed lady. But regardless, we're going to look at that when we come back from the break. But you saw, I'm sure you've heard the video by now, Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, they're panicking because young people quite simply are not going along with this anymore. And you have people who, I hate to say it, you have people like the Squad who are just, regardless of how much money they want to throw at it, they're not going to endorse them. Oh yeah, there he is. They are terrified. And I think we can work with that. Truly. I do think we can work with that. It's a crack in the veneer. It's a way to question the status quo. And once you start doing that, you just keep on doing it. And then it just gets worse. So see you soon. So where we left off last, again, talking about Adam Schiff getting his car broken into, which is, I think, probably my favorite part of the whole story still, because the rest of it's rather bleak. But we're talking about ways in which the media facade, the narrative, well, the government media alliance, whether actually on paper or not, is starting to show cracks much more rapidly with young people than I think it ever has in history. We all know that the K-12 and then subsequent college system is meant to absolutely brainwash people. And I find it very difficult to be terribly mad at the victims of a system that is working exactly as designed, at least for a while. There's got to be a little bit of grace. But unlike these very idealistic young people who have just spent their formative years in an educational system that told them that it was about good versus evil and right versus wrong and overly simplified narratives and which side was the quote unquote right side of history and which was the quote unquote wrong side of history, and simplified things to such terms. And they have now been put out into a world in which they're finding out it's not all that simple all the time. And in fact, all of the people who they might have looked up to previously, that they, you know, you might have had Joe Biden doing a little, I remember when he did a cameo on Parks and Recreation, and like, oh, he's so fun. And now they're seeing exactly how politics really work when it's not in a fictional MSNBC show. And it's really rather sad. We have a U.S. lawmaker, Jim Himes, who's a Democrat from Connecticut, who seems to have just thrown in the towel and just given up. And, you know, it's probably because he doesn't take his vitamins and he's just given up. But you, however, are in luck, because wouldn't you believe it? Vitamin Mineral Fusion is back in stock at InfoWars at 40% off. It's back. The platinum standard of advanced multivitamin formulas has returned. After being out of stock for months, there's no better time to make sure that you're boosting your natural systems and getting your essential vitamins, minerals, and nutrients than with Vitamin Mineral Fusion back in stock at 40% off. We don't live in a perfect world. Lord, don't we know that? Our diets no longer contain everything we need, and instead of just spending huge amounts of time and money to do so, Vitamin Mineral Fusion is here to help. This product contains vitamin C, D, E, and B12, calcium, magnesium, zinc, selenium, L-glutamine, CoQ10, and many more vital nutrients. In this time of need, it's especially crucial that we're giving our bodies what they need to function at optimum health. You got to keep your wits about you. Don't wait until it's out of stock again, though. Boost your natural systems and get vitamin mineral fusion today for 40% off at InfoWarsStore.com. And I bet Representative Jim Himes, Democrat from Connecticut, who said, just backing Israel and going along with whatever the lobbyists say, I bet he's not taking his vitamins. I can guarantee you he's not taking vitamin mineral fusion. That's 40% off now. So without further ado, let's look at this story. And then we're going to move into and going into the next hour. Not only are we going to be looking at a coalition of central bankers and some of the largest wielders of financial capital in the world coming together 2 weeks ago, kind of under the radar. We're also going to look into William Gates, who you might have heard a couple years ago wanted to launch particles into the sky to block out the sun. Well, just this morning from ABC News, it seems like we're going to go on ahead with that. Maybe. So we're going to look at that. But let's look now at this article. This is from responsiblestatecraft.org, written by Eli Clifton, published last year on December 5th, or 15th, sorry, 2023. A senior Democratic lawmaker recently said it's easier to back government policy in many instances at the expense of the Palestinians because pro-Israel lobbyists have a relatively more influential presence on Capitol Hill. Quote, the Palestinians have very legitimate claims and have been subject to brutal injustice, he said. Ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee said in a meeting with constituents on October 23rd. But, he added, pro-Israel groups, including J Street and the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, the one we've been talking about, make many members of Congress reflexively pro-Israel simply because it's the path of least resistance. And I don't know about you, that's exactly what I want to hear about out of my elected official. While polling shows that most Americans consider themselves to be pro-Israel, their support is not entirely unconditional when it comes to how the Israelis are waging the war against Hamas in Gaza. A recent survey of likely American voters found that 61% support the call for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, where weeks of intense bombing by the Israel Defense Forces have caused widespread devastation. Again, this was written back in December. Obviously, things have escalated even further now, but, you know. Here we are. Despite this widespread support, only 14% of the U.S. House of Representatives have come out publicly in favor of a ceasefire, which would, again, seem to be a no-brainer. It's like we don't want people dying. All right. Seems simple. It's not. But pro-Israel groups make significant campaign contributions, visit members of Congress frequently, and pressure them back to the activities of the Israeli government, critics who spoke with RSA. Again, Responsible Statecraft. Great article. Representative Himes said, held an online meeting to discuss the Israel-Palestine conflict with constituents on the 23rd, led by the Kit chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. According to a recording of the event obtained by Responsible Statecraft, when asked about his tendency to reflexively begin his statements with support for Israel, Himes responded with several answers, one of which addressed the near constant presence of pro-Israel lobbyists. Quote, in this office, I get 6 to 8 visits a year by APAC, which is a fairly right-wing pro-Israeli group, and J Street, which is a left-leaning pro-Israeli group. I have never had a visit, never once, and I've been doing this for 15 years, by a pro-Palestinian group. And again, I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm just sort of explaining the facts as they appear. And I think, therefore, the path of least resistance for an awful lot of members of Congress is to be reflexive of the way you were concerned about. And the reason I would love to talk more about that is because, you know, the Palestinians have very legitimate claims and in times and places have been subject to brutal injustice, and yet there is nobody telling their story. Himes pointed to the influence of AIPAC to help explain the lopsided support for Israel in Congress. AIPAC has been doing this for 60 years. They come in and they sit in the office and they say, yeah, you know, there's 3 things that we would really like you to consider doing. Are you going to do it? And I'm not saying AIPAC is good or bad, but I'm just saying that I know what is effective in educating members of Congress. And honestly, it breaks my heart that there isn't a Palestinian group that comes in and says, look, let us tell you what our aspirations are. Let us tell you some stories. Let us tell you what the settlers are doing outside of, you know, Ramallah. Sure. Crush that. I'd be curious to know what he means by path of least resistance, Foundation for Middle East Peace President Laura Friedman told Responsible Statecraft. Does he mean this is the path that gets me rewarded in terms of campaign support? Or on the other hand, how I avoid other possible negative consequences, like someone giving massive support to my primary opponent? Again, up until just a couple years ago, this was not even really a thing, and it's a whole different aspect to consider. Representative Himes has not traditionally received much financial support from pro-Israel groups. However, last year saw the most campaign spending by pro-Israel donors of any congressional cycle in the last 30 years. Amid this wave of money, the largest contributor to Himes' campaign in 2022 was AIPAC. The group has recently clashed publicly with several critics in Congress, ranging from Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat from Wisconsin, to Representative Thomas Massey, a Republican from Kentucky. Next year, AIPAC-affiliated groups are expected to spend upwards of $100 million on primary elections in an effort to oust Democratic lawmakers they view are insufficiently supportive of Israel or too vocal about Palestinian rights. And if you recall back to the article that we looked at the beginning of the show, they said they seem to have claimed only one loss in the primaries, which is insane. The influence of this campaign spending is well known among congressional insiders. Any member of Congress knows that AIPAC is associated indirectly with significant amounts of campaign spending if you're with them, and significant amounts against you if you're not with them, former Representative Brian Baird, a Democrat from Washington, told The New Yorker in 2014. It's been going on for a while. When key votes are cast, the question on the House floor troublingly is often not what is the right thing to do for the United States of America, but how is AIPAC going to score this? In his congressional votes and public statements, Representative Himes has charted a course in between his party's biggest supporters and biggest critics of Israel. He explained during the October 23rd meeting his reasons for not supporting the calls for a lasting ceasefire. Quote, unless somebody can convince me that there is an alternative mechanism for bringing these terrorists that perpetuated this grave crime against Israel to justice, I will not do that, Himes said in a reference to Hamas's attack on October 7th. Yet the congressman also opposed the move to censure Rashida Tlaib for her advocacy on the issue. My theme has been twofold, said Himes. Nobody backed me into a corner, which is why we will support Israel in the face of this disgusting attack. And number two, that we need to make sure Israeli response is moderated and they abide by the laws of armed conflict. The eight-term congressman, I lost my spot here, attended Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to a joint session of Congress in 2015, where he bashed President Obama's diplomacy with Iran and received a standing ovation. But Himes had harsh words for the controversial leader during the October 23rd meeting. The problem will not go away until there is a two-state solution, he said. Very sadly, the current Israeli Prime Minister has been doing pretty much everything he can do to make that an impossibility. And of course, that's part of the reason why the rage and anger rose to the levels it did prior to Hamas's attacks. So there you go. Our government, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the second hour of American Journal. I'm your host, L. Lauren. I'm thrilled to be here and thrilled to be talking with you. Going into this next hour, we're going to continue talking about AIPAC and Adam Schiff. I'm just kidding. We're not going to do that. We're done with that. But I wanted to, again, highlight that. I like talking about Adam Schiff getting his car broken into. But just as with AIPAC and the Israel facade cracks, you know, continuity here, there are many other ways to use massive amounts of fundraising and to wield financial and political power to strong arm people under your control. And just 2 weeks ago, an event took place in DC that brought together some of the world's most powerful financial controllers together into one room to get together to discuss exactly how you should live your life. And one of my favorite social media websites to peruse to see what these people are up to, because they don't post on Twitter and all of their standard sites anymore, but they openly brag about it on LinkedIn and they leave their comments open because it's nothing but sycophants and, you know, people who are on the same page over there. But Melinda Gates, you might be familiar, the I believe officially ex-wife of Bill Gates, has been doing her own little girl boss thing since they split. And she posted on her LinkedIn a image of talking about going to a, is that the full post? Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. She posted, she said, every year leaders from around the world gather at the World Bank and IMF spring meetings in DC to align on efforts to reduce poverty and accelerate economic growth. And every year I keep a close eye on how these efforts will benefit women who are often left behind when big policy decisions get made. Here are a few outtakes from the last meetings where I spoke about solutions that can help women entrepreneurs access the capital they need to pursue the opportunities they want. So Melinda Gates is in DC. And did you know the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were there with central bankers discussing again, not only the United States financial future, but the global financial future at large and how to distribute things, not only fairly. But of course, we know the most important thing is being equitable. There's Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the WHO. He's got a nice long history, rubbing elbows with all manner of activists and influencer, as well as central bankers. Every time I see his face, I get mad. So we're going to look at that when we get into this first hour. And then after we get after that, we're going to look at her X-Man's latest goings on, which you might be familiar. They're trying to put particles into the atmosphere to block out the sun. This is something that has both George Soros, you might be familiar with him, and Bill Gates have both gone on the record recently and have poured funding into doing. It's an absolutely wild situation. And again, when we're talking about young people who've been promised that they're going to do everything they can to mitigate climate change, and that, you know, if we all stop driving cars, we can save the planet. These people have absolutely zero regard for the potential outcomes of this, which could be, I don't want to say world ending, but they could have long reaching effects on our food supply, our water tables, and everything in between. And they acknowledge this in official reports, but say that it's worth it to try. So we're going to look at Melinda Gates, again, rubbing elbows with bankers and other journalists and influencers. And then we're going to look at the climate cloud seeding thing. Well, it's not cloud seeding, it's atmosphere seeding. And then after that, we're going to take calls and maybe we can work on some stuff together and put some dots together. So I'm looking forward to it. And I'll see you back here in just a bit. Kind of outline then how the next hour-ish is going to go. And then after that, we're going to take calls and talk about this. If you want to call in, if nobody calls in, then I'll just keep rambling into the ether. Clearly have a talent at that. But I would like to direct your attention now to some meetings that took place in D.C. over the last couple of weeks. One set of meetings that took place from April 17th to the 19th, and another set of events and activities that overlapped on both sides that took place from April 15th to the 20th. 15th to the 20th. Crush that. I don't know about you. This is an entirely different discussion for a different time. But my social media feeds as of late on Twitter or Truth Social or wherever have you have just been filled with nonstop interpersonal drama, and I cannot stand it. So I'd like to direct your attention to something you might not have heard of. And if you have, then I'm proud of you. The spring meetings of the Board of Governors for the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank Group came together a couple weeks ago to bring together, according to their site here on their Spring Meetings 2024 page, to bring together central bankers, ministers of finance and development, parliamentarians, private sector executives, representatives from civil society organizations, and academics to discuss issues of global concern, including the world economic outlook, easy, poverty eradication, simple, economic development, and aid effectiveness. Also featured are seminars, regional briefings, press conferences, and many other events focused on the global economy, international development, and the world's financial system. Lovely. The main ministerial meetings and events will take, again, this is retroactively written, but took place 17th to the 19th, and then the events overlapping from the 15th to the 20th. It then lists below this a list of media partners, which include the Financial Times, the Africa Report, the Banker, which I'm not even familiar with, going to look at that one later, Bloomberg, CNBC, CNN Espanol, DevX, Euronews, Foreign Affairs, and the Washington Post, among others that I cannot pronounce. At this meeting, it brought together two entities. Oop. Pardon one second. I am I'm so sorry. One second. I am lost my spot. Well, essentially, I saw that I'm so sorry. This is the part where I would normally just ramble to you. But essentially, again, they got together. One of their transforming challenges that they wanted to bring about is expanding healthcare coverage for all. Again, these are very lofty goals from people who sit in ivory towers, and they know just exactly what is good for you, and will hear nothing but their narrative in place. Everything that is done here is, of course, to enforce and to further the sustainable development goals that were outlined by the United Nations, which were formerly known as the Millennium Development Goals, but they fell short of that, so they rebranded. And before that, they were known as Agenda 21, and then so on and so forth. I'm sure you're familiar. The seminars that took place, they had a debate on the global economy that was moderated by Richard Quest, an anchor of CNN. They asked where the money was going, moderated by CNBC International. They asked what it would take to accelerate and access and improve lives in Africa, and how to, again, expand healthcare coverage for all. This is with the World Bank Group. And these seminars are rather long, but they want to expand health services to expand healthcare services to 1.5 billion people. They say that healthcare is a fundamental investment that one can unlock human capital and economic dividends for countries. But the challenge to bring more care to more people requires political will, financing, and partnership. This was the main theme at Transforming Challenge into Action, Expanding Healthcare Coverage for All, where World Bank Group President Ajay Banga announced an ambitious plan to support countries in delivering quality, affordable health services to 1.5 billion people by 2030. During a fireside chat moderated by international broadcast journalist Shankuntala, Ajay Banga and Tedros Ghebreyesus, the director general of the WHO, they spoke about the challenges to expanding health coverage and the urgency of doing so. He said the new plan would widen the aperture of the bank's priorities from maternal and child health services to the health needs of people over their lifetimes, a move that also responds to rapidly aging populations, the surge in non-communicable diseases, and the associated healthcare costs. Following the fireside, the Minister of Finance of Japan announced the establishment of a universal healthcare knowledge hub to enhance health and finance ministry's capacities, an initiative also supported by the bank and the World Health Organization. Two separate panel discussions ensued, with country and civil society leaders discussing what it would take to build resilient health systems. Again, these are easy questions. Expand coverage and improve the health of populations so that the countries can thrive. Again, to unlock human capital. We are nothing but chattel to these people. But what did Melinda Gates have to say about it? Let me grab my link here real quick, and we're going to look at it. Here we go. She published an article in Bloomberg on April 15th that said women entrepreneurs in the world are good for, I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh at this as a woman. Women entrepreneurs can make the world $6 trillion richer. The finance industry, she claims, needs to redesign its lending practices to give more consideration to small borrowers, especially women. It then lists her description there as Melinda Gates is a... Melinda Gates is co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, founder of Pivotal Ventures, which is her venture capitalist fund, and the author of The Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Changes the World. So that's beautiful. So she writes in Bloomberg, I think she probably had someone write it for her, but she says every small business owner knows how difficult it can be to get access to affordable capital. But for many women in the global South, it's not just difficult, it's often impossible. A few years ago in Senegal, I met a woman who decided to do something about that problem. In 2017, Tiaba Camara Sai left her job as the head of a consulting firm and co-founded WIC Capital, an investment fund for women entrepreneurs in West Africa. Since then, WIC Capital has raised more than $5 million and invested in 8 businesses run by women who knocked on far too many closed doors before WIC saw their potential. One of these women co-founded a company that turns abandoned tires, which would otherwise gather rainwater and breed mosquitoes, into fuel for factories. Fashion designers who struggled to find funding despite an MBA and years of experience was able to grow her company and now sells her designs to customers around the world. And Issu Sako, I'm sure I crushed that, expanded a business that bakes French pastries into native grains and supports 20 local suppliers and 75 employees. But, Melinda Gates continues, as inspiring as these stories are, they underscore a grave problem. When women entrepreneurs succeed, it's in spite of the system, not because of it. Worldwide, there's a $1.7 trillion gap between the credit women need and what they're able to get. Estimates suggest that by closing the gap, as much as $6 trillion in global GDP can be unlocked. That's a net gain for the world that we cannot afford to pass up. A confluence of crises, wars, climate change, the pandemic has left low and middle income countries with sluggish economic growth. 43% of the world's poorest countries have lower per capita GDP. I said GPT, AI on the brain, now than in 2019. The problem and the opportunity are especially profound in Africa, which has the highest proportion of women entrepreneurs in the world. And I'm going to completely deviate from my planned notes to tell you, though, that entities like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have a very long history of involvement in Africa. For example, in 2017, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation worked in conjunction with the GSMA, which is a global mobile something alliance, as well as an entity known as Copagas, to introduce in Tanzania a system called Pay As You Go, wherein they went into some of the poorest countries or poorest areas, very rural areas, and installed very high-tech gas delivery systems to power stoves. They then put these people on a GSMA-provided mobile phones grid. And then, in order to access this new installed gas stoves, they required them to put all of their money into their provided digital banks. And in doing so, not only did it become more expensive for people, but it also, because the investment came from outside of their area, took away any sort of fuel gathering circulation within their own economy and put these people on a path for a lifelong venture into microtransactions simply to cook their food. Absolutely insane. If you want to look into this, it's the Copagas GSMA Alliance Pay As You Cook. So they love Africa because they can test out what they want to do elsewhere in the world later. And they come in and say, we're helping. We're here to help you. So Melinda Gates, who again was a part of that in 2017, said that no country can grow healthier and more prosperous while leaving behind half its population. We need women to be in debt. We need women to be in the credit system. We need women to be on our digital banking systems. They aren't now. We need to unlock their capital. So as leaders gather at the World Bank and IMF this week to find ways to accelerate economic growth, they must also seek ways to unlock women's economic power, starting with access to capital. And, you know, I'm a pretty, I'm like a half modern lady. I think women are strong and smart and capable, right? But this fundamentally seeks to uproot cultural systems, family systems, abolish the nuclear family, to send all women into an office, to put them on their digital system. And it's just, you know, the option should certainly be there, but I see it as something significantly more nefarious. And again, I think this is somewhere where they're ultimately going to be losing young people. When you talk about women being involved in the workforce, you even see the discourse online. Granted, it's varying and in various states of women need to be in the workforce all the time. If you want to come and raise children, then you're a traitor to feminism, to people now realizing that there might actually be more important things in life to them as a woman. And I find this pretty sad. I don't, kind of a conflict of emotions. She continues on, though, about these systems. She said these systems are rife with bias from lenders who can still legally discriminate against women in 96 countries. When a woman walks through the door with a good idea, a smart business plan, and a dream to improve her future, lenders too often see only risk. And the women who do get loans often receive far smaller ones than men, even though evidence from MCOPA... Oh, wait, is that the same one? Hang on. I actually didn't catch that until just now. Is that the same one as Copagas? Surely it is. Oh, it totally is. That's okay. Click that link if you don't mind of the MCOPA. This is part of the same COPA gas. If you scroll down at the bottom, they talk about how they're involved with the MCOPA monetary system and they connect to it through their smartphones. This is 100% the blueprint. This is the digital economy they want people on. I didn't even catch this earlier. I'm sorry for going off the provided kind of plan here. How MCOPA works: access products and services that unlock progress in your life in four easy steps. Instant access, make a deposit and instantly take home the latest smartphone. Make easy daily, weekly, or monthly payments. Own your product and build a credit history with MCOPA. Unlock access to a wider range of MCOPA products and services. This is 100% what they tested out in Tanzania through a separate offshoot. It's not haha funny, but it is kind of funny. I didn't even notice that before. So again, she says that through their MCOPA asset financing company that serves customers across Africa, including the Copagas GSMA Alliance in Tanzania from 2017, it shows that women are 10% less likely than men to default on their repayments. Fortunately, there are a number of reforms leaders can pursue that would address the financing gap. First, government should remove the barriers facing responsible lenders trying to serve low-income customers while still protecting people from predatory lenders. That means creating systems in which minimum capital requirements and compliance expectations increase along with the size and complexity of the lender in question, because it doesn't make sense to treat a small microfinance lender the same as a full-service bank. When they say microfinance, again, this is a microtransaction system from hell. Second, the development community should make funds from donor countries available to lenders to help manage their perception of risk. If lenders know they're partially covered in case of default, they're more likely to invest in a more diverse range of entrepreneurs. And we all know that that's the most important thing. By providing those guarantees, donors can also incentivize larger financial institutions to loan to smaller, more nimble ones in their own countries. Third, the government should invest in digital infrastructure so that lenders can add customers more cheaply and assess creditworthiness in new ways. Women are less likely than men to have formal credit histories, but they may have informal ones built by paying bills one at a time, saving and pooling money in community groups. With digital tools, lenders can evaluate customers based on less traditional data and share that information securely with other lenders. And one of the funny things about the Copagas system that I keep referencing from Tanzania is that's baked into it all. The amount of data they collect at every single point is insane. And I fundamentally believe that the people who are on these just, they either don't know or there's no other option. And it makes me very sad. So she then says, think of this as a credit bureau designed around the realities of the informal economy that exists around the global South. Finally, donor countries must fully fund the World Bank's International Development Association, which in turn must prioritize the lowest income countries in its efforts to reduce poverty and spur economic growth. By offering loans on better terms than the broader market, the IDA helps lay the foundation for those countries to build stronger financial systems and in turn invest back into their people and businesses. Getting capital to women is not just the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. Riveting. Across WIC Capital's investment portfolio, sales are up 5 times, and the fund has a goal of creating 3,000 jobs in the next 7 years. And that's just from 8 businesses. I'm sorry, that doesn't seem like very many. What do I know? A full quarter of all African women are entrepreneurs. Imagine if their futures didn't depend solely on a few visionaries like Tiaba Sy. Imagine the progress that would be possible for their families, communities, and countries if those who hold the keys to capital open the doors to all. Lovely discussion, again, centering around the IMF and the World Bank. But there was a separate meeting that also took place with another organization you might be familiar with. A few years ago, people raised eyebrows at MasterCard's new quest into inclusive capitalism. And in fact, there was a council for inclusive capitalism with the Vatican at one point that had, like, oh man, there were Rothschilds. It was a very weird entity. But MasterCard has since kind of toned down the weird cabalistic sense of things and have since kind of rebranded as the Center for Inclusive Growth. It's the 10th anniversary year of this, and they had their own summit alongside the World Bank and the IMF, and it was called the Global Inclusive Growth Summit. And they claim to advance real solutions today to today's most pressing challenges through collaboration and candid conversation among entrepreneurs, innovators, policymakers, and emerging change makers. This was also attended by Melinda Gates, as well as a ton of other influencers. And, well, there's also Elton John. If you go to the homepage for it's globalinclusivegrowthsummit.com, which would take you to their summit and where you can see all their talks, you just see Elton John. I don't know what he's doing there. He's there and he's staring you right into your soul. It said it's never been more important to understand how constantly shifting demographics, circumstances, and technologies affect the growth, security, and prosperity of communities all over the world. They're wanting us to innovate for a healthy world. They want to focus on, inclusive intelligence. I said intrusive in my brain. And then digital drivers for an inclusive economy. Again, when we're talking about these things, and we're talking about extending these to the global South and African countries first, yeah, it's a testing grounds. And by the time the infrastructure has kind of been perfected, and by the time people realize what's rolling out elsewhere, it's a lot more difficult to circumvent something that has, again, billions, perhaps even trillions in some instances of capital pushing for, again, digital dollar, digital banks, central bank digital currencies, this constant monitoring of credit. You might even notice, I don't know specifically which bank you bank with. I think if I did, that would be kind of weird. But you might even have noticed within your own bank account, and I challenge all of you to do this. You probably have in your bank account a little section where you have some little pie chart or a little bar graph that tells you, oh, you did so-and-so on this, so-and-so on, you know, utilities, so-and-so on transportation, and so forth. If you go read the fine print for that, I would 95% bet that your bank has, contracted out that service to a third party. It's one of the things that absolutely shocked me to find out, but it's very difficult to find a bank that doesn't do it. If you have a little pie chart in your bank account, they've probably sold your financial data to a company that, again, wants to know exactly how much money the average American has in their bank account so they can squeeze every last dollar out of you. These are very insidious systems. And as someone who has a pretty tenuous, if not completely, you know, we're working on it, a grasp on how the whole financial system works in general, I find it absolutely horrifying. So again, you have Elton John here, you have Melinda Gates here, you have they have a whole list of speakers here. The Secretary of Commerce from the United States of America, Rosario Dawson, who, oh my gosh, her description on the Inclusive Growth Summit calls her an activist. I don't know how to feel about that. An activist. The chairman and CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, scrolling over next to Elton John on the right. These are people who spoke again at this inclusive capitalism thing. Albert Bourla, we have the chairperson of a philanthropy foundation, the president of the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations. So when we come back, we're going to look more into this, listen to a couple of things that they said, and then we're going to get into Bill Gates and his quest to control the weather and to cool down the earth, which is absolutely wild. So I'll see you soon. Thanks for watching. Oh, never mind. I'm sorry. The count out is like, I can't see it. There's little squares in the way. Crushed it. All right, cool. We're going to look at this. We're going to listen to a couple of things that they have to say. And all of this happened just a couple weeks ago in D.C. And I, at the time, I didn't know it was happening until I took a retroactive look. And I think these things are very important to pay attention to because it's coming whether you like it or not. So it's better to be prepared for it. So I'll see you in just a second. So on that break, you're in luck. I ended up pulling up the link for you guys. I wanted to show you this exact system that I was talking about because I wanted to show you how insidious it is. Again, this Copagaz distribution system that they rolled out in Tanzania in 2017 is essentially everything that I see people claiming is coming here. And the people that they claim are going to bring it here are doing it there. It's at copagaz.com. So pretty easy to get there if you'd like to look at this yourself. But at the top, it says, we give families a healthier option. They say that cooking with charcoal and firewood is equivalent to being exposed to 400 cigarettes per hour. While people want cleaner fuels, paying for gas up front is too expensive for most, exposing more than 80% of families in sub-Saharan Africa to harmful fumes every single day. Through smart meters and pay-as-you-go technology, we've grown fast to one of the biggest national distributors in Tanzania. We've grown fast, Copagaz says. We're working tirelessly to bring families a new alternative. And again, they outline the five basic tenets of the system. Mobile payments, LPG infrastructure, smart meters, customer service, and technical support. The pay-as-you-go technology wants them, it lets them, again, be on a microtransaction system. They have to sign up for their Copa Bank system, so they have a constant monitoring of their exactly how much money they have in their account. And they call it convenient. And then, of course, at the very bottom of the page, they have hashtag cook better. And, of course, the pictures of the areas of Tanzania, I mean, are truly not great conditions for people. And I think the focus there should be, again, getting food on the table, not whether or not you're carbon emissions are too much. But, you know, that might just be me. But if you look, again, Vodacom, Airtel, Aris, Clean Cooking Alliance, GSMA, which is a huge provider, the MIT D-Lab, the very deep and insidious thing. And again, people who claim this is going to come here, they are lining out, or they're outlining exactly how they're going to do that. So this was mentioned, again, at the Global Inclusive Growth Summit, which also took place a couple weeks ago in D.C. And I do have a list of the speakers there for you. This was attended by Rosario Dawson, Elton John, Melinda French Gates, as well as the CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, and many, many others. So when you think about people who are going to determine the systems of financial inclusion. Again, I know that I personally feel better knowing that Elton John is there giving speeches about this. We also have Shamina Singh, who is the founder and president of the MasterCard Center of Inclusive Growth, which is, of course, this. Michael Froman, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. You might be familiar. The president of Howard University. A couple of activist-type folks, the president of Americas of MasterCard, Linda Kirkpatrick, Aria Lobarty, an actor, author, and UNICEF supporter. What a resume. Scrolling down. I mean, it's just a lovely group of people. And so these are the people giving speeches at the Inclusivity Summit, sitting alongside Melinda Gates saying, you know what I think people who have hardly anything to their name need? They need a digital bank system and cell phones and microtransactions. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy. This is the footprint for it. sorry, I just scrolled down and got jump scared by Elton John again, which is a good time. This took place from April 18th. Through, I believe, the 20th, we're going to go to the agenda page right here. I'll drop this in the chat for you really quick. Boop. So just give a rundown of this. And then when we come back, we're going to look at Bill Gates' engineering of the clouds. And then we can all talk about it together because I'm looking forward to that very much. So hopefully that happens. So looking at the Inclusive Growth Summit, the outline, I just wanted to highlight some of these talks and who's giving them. They have a talk where a world where no one gets left behind. And you can go back and watch through these things. The world where no one gets left behind, again, was hosted by Shamina Singh, who is the founder and president of the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth, and was the speaker was, of course, Elton John. We have the cutting edge of climate change that came after this. It was moderated by Nigel Topping, who's the UN climate change high-level champion. I didn't even know you could be a high-level champion that. You have Critical Capital closing the $160 trillion women's wealth gap. Melinda French Gates, again, we read her article there in Bloomberg, philanthropist and activist for gender equality in conversation with Rosario Dawson, who I don't even know what she was in, an actor and activist for gender equality, share their personal perspectives on where women stand in today's world, how far have we come, how far do we have to go? I'm sure that's lovely. Challenging convention, leading beyond borders. In this dynamic session, we bring together two individuals who epitomize purpose-driven action in today's complex world. Prime Minister Mia Armour-Motley of Barbados, renowned for her pivotal role in climate action and finance reform, joins Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations and Chair of the United Nations Sustainable Development Group, Amina Mohammed, in conversations with Homi Karas, a senior fellow at the Center for Sustainable Development at Brookings. They will delve into the intersection of power and purpose. Beyond boundaries, focusing on pressing global issues such as the future of sustainable development, just transition for a livable planet. They say that word a lot. It's a big red flag. Anytime you see the phrase just transition, like, run. And what small island developing states need from the global community. Again, it is when we talk on a nationwide scale of equity and forced equity. It's already pretty awful. When we talk about a global scale, it gets significantly worse. And when you have entities like the IMF and the World Bank and other central banking entities who are all on board with this, it gets pretty spooky pretty quickly. There's another one that took place called Inclusive Futures, Making the Next Generation Work. And I don't know about you, but they've talked young people of the world that there's not going to be a world to inherit, that there's nothing to build into. And so now they're just absolutely scratching their heads about how to get them to work and how to unlock that quote unquote human capital, which I find pretty, well, it doesn't sound very fun to me. Drivers of inclusive growth in Africa. Who owns our thoughts? Neurotech and you. Another one. A human rights lawyer, Jaron Gisner, tackles a mind-bending question. Who owns our thoughts in the age of neurotechnology? The co-founder of the Neuro Rights Foundation explores the ethical and legal challenges of brain-computer interfaces and other neurotechnologies and their relevance as we think about inclusive growth. The future of human rights and the very definition of what it means to be human. Lovely. Investing to end poverty, inclusion is a team sport. Oh, boy. So again, all of this is at the globalgrowthsummit.com. It took place just 2 weeks ago. People are still talking about it online, and I just caught wind of it just a little while ago. Now, when you look at the offshoots of it, when you look at the same entities, the same foundations, the same NGOs, the same 501c3s, and global entities at large, it same people, maybe some new faces here and there, and because not a lot of people pay attention to these summits or even knew that they took place, some of these topics are absolutely wild to me. Again, are your thoughts your own in the age of neurotechnology? I don't know, man. I don't know. So when we come back at the beginning of the next one, we're going to quickly go through the absolutely insane venture that Bill Gates and George Soros are on the record as not only supporting but funding, since we've spoken about Melinda Gates, another person who wants to have every control of your life. We've talked about political, we've talked about financial. He wants to control the weather, and he's just crazy enough to try to do it. So when we come back, we're going to look at that. We're going to do calls. Thanks for watching. I'm having a good time. And I've got a last little story to bring to your attention that's been in the public eye on and off again for a while. But just this morning, ABC News put out a new story. Let me take you back to last year at the Munich Security Conference really quick. To quote Mr. George Soros, he said, quote, our civilization is in danger of collapsing because of the inexorable advance of climate change. Very uplifting. He said that slashing heat-trapping emissions and adapting to a hotter world are necessary but not sufficient. Quote, the climate system is broken and it needs to be repaired. The former UK climate envoy, David King, said that we need to refreeze the Arctic. A solar geoengineering process that Soros is behind and now funding, as well as Bill Gates and others, is known as marine cloud brightening, would reflect sunlight away from the ice layer formed of the Arctic Sea during the polar winter with year-on-year growth of the last ice layer, King said. So now we're going to look at this ABC News article that was published just this morning. It's titled, Controversial Methods to Cool Earth by Reflecting Sunlight Gain Traction as Global Temperatures Rise. Again, this is one of those things where if you discuss it outside of the prescribed media narrative, you get painted as a crazy person. Shout out to all the people that knew that the floods in Dubai were due to cloud seeding. They even admitted that in Bloomberg, by the way. They claim in this ABC News article from this morning that different types of solar geoengineering are seeing a push for more research. The article begins, the planet has been experiencing a relentless stretch of record-breaking global temperatures with the rate and impact of climate change accelerating, according to the World Meteorological Organization, as the impacts of human-amplified climate change intensify and become more severe, relatively untouched ideas are gaining momentum as potential short-term solutions to lower the Earth's temperature. I would like to introduce you to the concept of solar radiation modification, or solar geoengineering is a concept that covers several different technologies or approaches to essentially reflect the sunlight back into space to manipulate the planet temperature. What could go wrong? So what would that look like? ABC News published just yesterday a 10-minute long video on the subject, but we really only need about a minute and a half of it, so I'd like to watch it with you. It says the title of this video they published yesterday is called The Power of Us, Can We Intentionally Cool the Earth?
San Francisco
Gotta
Bay,
see it to believe it.
On deck the decommissioned USS Hornet. Scientists from the University of Washington and a group called Silver Lining are giving us a glimpse at a first-of-its-kind outdoor study meant to develop a technology called marine cloud brightening.
Woo! Chilly up here. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
This is Command Center. What's happening here?
We're just discussing the weather condition of the day to pick up the data that we are trying to measure.
Here, they're blowing tiny particles of salt water into the air.
In position.
Liquid check.
So someday, we may be able to intentionally cool the Earth.
Air on.
15%. Opening the valve. 20%.
There is the plume. We can see it.
Yeah.
All of this to recreate something that humans have unintentionally been doing for more than a century.
If you look at satellite images, you can see where ships go over the ocean, the sulfur they're producing from their engines produce small particles in the atmosphere and often leave brightened cloud streaks. We call them ship tracks. What we would be doing is making a clean ship track out of sea salt.
While this experiment is super small and not meaning to brighten clouds yet, this is how it would work. Pressurized air mixes with water and salt concentrate. Then that salt water blows out of the head of a device like this and goes into the atmosphere. The perfectly sized sodium molecule gives already existing stratocumulus clouds a boost, helping them attract more water. More water can make them brighter. When those clouds are brighter, they reflect more sunlight, which can cool the temperature at the surface.
It's so easy, right? But wouldn't you believe it, last June in 2023, the White House published a 42-page page-turner about exactly this and outlining the different ways that we could approach this pressing issue and how we could, again, move forward in solar radiation modification. It's, of course, a very controversial topic, but according to ABC News, of course, it's gathering support, even though varying arguments span from not giving other people the idea to do this so that you don't have bad actors and or terrorism groups threatening to, again, send particles into the atmosphere globally to, I guess, kill the planet. Bad idea, right? As well as, again, there's no really good way to test this out without potentially putting a microclimate at great risk. And while these people love to pretend like cloud seeding in specific areas, damming and rerouting rivers for their hydroelectric dams isn't also perpetuating small microclimate change. In fact, it could be that we are engineering the very thing that they claim is due to cars. You know, when you take water from one place, move it elsewhere, going to change the climate. So we're going to look at the congressionally mandated report on solar radiation modification. Again, this was published as a 42-page report, 44 rather, page report that was put out last year on June 30th, 2023. It's got an absolute mouthful of a name. The Congressionally Mandated Research Plan and an Initial Research Governance Framework Related to Solar Radiation Modification. You go down to the third page, it says about this report, this research plan was prepared in response to a requirement in a joint explanatory statement accompanying Division B of the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2022. The congressional directive also requests that OSTP develop a research governance framework to provide guidance on transparency, engagement, and risk management for publicly funded work in solar geoengineering research. Again, this has already been funded for the last 4 years, at least through the Bill Gates Harvard program. Real quick, it's the Harvard Solar Geoengineering Research Program that's received its Open Philanthropy Project, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, all the same suspects, really. But now we're getting the government involved, which makes me super duper excited. The document focuses on atmospheric-based approaches to solar radiation modification. Scrolling down to the past executive summary, on page 6, they discuss developing a scenario for solar radiation modification, in which they say that a set of scenarios should include those carefully designed to produce specific climate outcomes. For example, peak shaving, in quotes, or cooling the Arctic and or other regions, as well as those that might be implemented without having been carefully designed. SRM scenario development is an iterative process where scenarios are periodically revised based on updated policy choices, new observations, and improved process-based understanding. Since SRM is intended to reduce risks associated with climate change, a research program would most usefully assess risks and benefits associated with scenarios in comparison to risks associated with plausible climate change scenarios not involving SRM. I think it gets down into the... to the research plan, and then I would want to highlight before we go to the next break the state of understanding of where we're at here. A variety of unintended outcomes of SRM are not well understood, and there may be others of which we are not aware. The known unknowns include potential changes in precipitation patterns, stratospheric temperatures, ozone amounts, sea level rise, patterns of climate variability, ocean acidification, it's a very long list, productivity and mixing, terrestrial vegetation, coral reefs, biodiversity, crop production, and ecosystems. Model simulations show that the chemistry of the stratosphere may change and atmospheric circulations may intensify in ways that will lead to seasonal scale impacts, such as more frequent extreme drought or precipitation events. Evaluating SRM outcomes and their associated risks would involve establishing the climate context of an SRM scenario, where the context includes the outcomes and risks in today's world and those projected for the future without SRM implementation. Gaps remain in our understanding of how these deployments might irreversibly alter the Earth's climate system. The long-term risks of SRM deployment should be evaluated using risk versus risk approach, since it could potentially prevent or ameliorate some of the irreversible impacts of GHG-induced warming, such as sea level rise, emissions from thawing permafrost, and loss of biodiversity. It's like when you see an ad for a pharmaceutical product, and then at the very end, they list out all the things that could go wrong in like that very quick, very difficult to understand language. This is on this 44-page report. This is on page 15, just kind of buried in the middle. It's not even labeled very clearly. That one stuck out to me the most. So again, you got to thank Bill Gates and George Soros. Between the politics, the financial system, and our weather, I think they've got us all covered. So when we come back, we'll take some calls. So see you soon. Hi there. Welcome back. We're in the top of the third hour, and if you're still here, God bless you, and thanks for sticking with me. I've really enjoyed hosting today. We've covered so far, again, the presence of AIPAC in our political system. We then moved to the inclusion and growth summits that involved anyone from Melinda Gates to activists to, central bankers, and also the CEO of Pfizer, of course, to decide how we can implement microtransaction systems and absolutely invasive financial monitoring systems. And then we looked at briefly, again, the Bill Gates Soros plot to block out the sun to cool the earth. So now this is just a quick little break here, but I do want to put out the number if you'd like to call in and discuss any of this, add your thoughts. Roast me if you feel, and no, I'm just kidding, don't do that, because I will cry on air. I will do it. The number is 1-877-789-2539. That's 1-877-789-2539. And anything you want to add to it, honestly. And it is a good time also to remind you while we're here and while you could potentially be calling in that because you have people that are trying to control your food system, control the very weather, the air you breathe, that it's never been a better time to take control of your own health. And wouldn't you know it, that back for the first time in a long time, Vitamin Mineral Fusion is back in stock at 40% off at the InfoWarsStore.com. It's back. It's the platinum standard of advanced multivitamin formulas, and it's returned. It's been out of stock for months. I know you've just been at home like, when are they going to get back in stock? They did it. It's done. There's no better time to make sure that you're boosting your natural systems. They're trying to boost your atmosphere. You can boost yourself at home. And getting your essential vitamins, minerals, and nutrients, you can do it with Vitamin Mineral Fusion. Back in stock at 40% off. We don't live in a perfect world. Lord knows. Our diets no longer contain everything we need. And instead of spending huge amounts of time and money to do so, Vitamin Mineral Fusion is here to help. This product contains vitamins C, D, E, B12, calcium, magnesium, zinc, selenium, L-glutamine, CoQ10, and many other vital nutrients. We're in a time of need. We're in a time of crisis. What was it they said during coronavirus? In these difficult and unprecedented times, it's especially crucial that we all go outside and we clap every day for the nurses going home, and that we're also giving our bodies what they need to function at their optimum health. So don't wait until it's out of stock again, because you're just going to be sitting at home crying. So call in, or well, go to the website. It's InfoWarsStore.com and get your Vitamin Mineral Fusion. You know, I think that's a great idea. You could go outside and clap every day for nurses going home, or you could go get that instead. I feel like the choice is pretty obvious. So anywho, do that. All right. But I'm looking forward to talking with you all about it. Anything that you have to add, anything that, again, I became sentient, I swear, in my late 20s, probably 27 or 28 years old. So I've got a lot to learn. I know that this is a very intelligent audience that knows a whole lot. And this is the thing that I enjoy the very, very most on my own show. Not to, you know, it's called Big Dig Energy. Dig. All right. Dig. But the conversation is the thing that I enjoy the most. So I'm looking forward to this. And hopefully I won't be quite so awkward. On the next go round. I'm not going to say my Twitter handle on here because it does have a swear word in it. Rachel Maddow once referred to me as some word that rhymes with Mitch, I know, on Twitter. This was after Mark Meadows submitted one of my reports on the 2020 election. That's a different conversation for a different time, though. Good times. Oh, no, it's Paul Gosar, not Mark Meadows, but still. That was one of my, it was one of the highlights, honestly, watching Rachel Maddow get apoplectic with rage over having to say my username. So when people are like, why won't you change it? That is literally why. So when we come back, call in, let's talk about it. I would love to. And we'll rock out the next hour. See you, American Journal. Welcome back, everybody. We got 22 minutes and 30 seconds for this segment here. If you wanted to call in, again, the number is 1-877-789-2539. We can talk about anything we talked about today. We can talk about something else if you want. So I want to go first, guys. We're going to go to Terry in PA, I assume, Pennsylvania, who said he wants to discuss any of the topics that have been discussed today. So hello, Terry.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
I'm great.
A little nervous, though, if it wasn't obvious.
Oh, that's understandable. You have a big audience. I really like all the things that you're saying today. They're very informational things to take in, to understand. This whole system is like so evil. It's not good. And I'm indebted to people like you and Alex and everyone that has brought truth out in the open, and so that people can see and judge for themselves what is really going on in this world. And it's not good. It's not good.
Well, I thank you very much for that. I would like to preface this with saying that's a very, very kind compliment you've paid me there, but I wouldn't put myself in the same stratosphere as someone like Alex. But I will tell you that it's not good, but again, I've got the cringy Facebook post archive to prove it. I believed a lot of the things that I fundamentally reject at every single level just a few years ago. And so I really do feel like we're at an inflection point where there's too many things that they just can't keep control of anymore. And again, we see them scrambling. And I truly have a very optimistic outlook for our future, because once you see it, you can't unsee it. You know, I'm pretty late to the party, but I'm happy to be here. I'm thrilled to be here. And I genuinely think it's all going to be all right in this crazy world in the end. I really, really do believe it. So thank you for your compliment. Again, it means the world. I'm just trying to figure it out with you too. And I'm sure there's so many things that I don't even know I don't know. So thanks for being part of it.
Yeah. our government is truly, truly evil. These people do not care about us, and people need to understand that. And I'm hoping that everyone understands that they're only in it for the gain, what they can gain from it. And it's not what our forefathers wanted for this country. It's not what God wanted for this country. And it's sad to see that it's come to this point.
Sometimes you got to see how bad it gets in order to like really have a perspective, though. You know, a lot of people with some of the most powerful stories had to hit rock bottom or pretty darn close before they, you know, turned it all around. So I appreciate your kind words, and I don't want to leave you within a feeling of doom and gloom, because I'm here. I'm fighting till the last breath leaves my lungs. And I know that a lot of other people are too. So thanks for calling in, and I hope to catch you around sometime.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. All right, cool. Sorry, I'm new to this, clearly. Can we go to Tim in Seattle? Who wants to talk about Bill Gates. He's in the belly of the beast.
How's it going?
So.
Yes.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Again, a little nervous getting the swing of things, though. But so you're in Seattle. You're like in like Gates territory. What do you want to talk about?
Well, no, actually, this is Tim Lashley territory. Bill Gates messed up and did all this stuff, and so I've been protesting him ever since February of 2020. So it's not Bill Gates' territory anymore. Yeah. I was just curious. I play a ton of clips. I love playing the Melinda Gates clip when she's talking about Epstein when I'm at the Gates Foundation. But I was just curious, is there anything spicier that I could be playing at the Gates Foundation to cause irreparable harm against his reputation? Because he's spraying the atmosphere. He's robbing us of our topsoil, disrupting farms, everything. There's nothing that this evil bastard, excuse my language, but this evil bastard is doing. He's doing it all. So do you think that there's anything super, super, super spicy that I could be playing? What do you recommend?
Well, So I have something in mind. If you bear with me really quick, I'm going to look through my files. There was some reports that came out, I believe in the 2015 era, talking about the massive amount of damage the Gates Foundation did in Africa and also in some rural Chinese areas. And there were some videos that came along with it. I think I can at least point you towards one of the PDFs to get you on the way, because these videos were spicy. And this was back when everyone, you know, I remember reading when he signed up for the, what was it, the giving pledge, and they're like, he's going to give away his money, and everyone, oh, what a scam, right? Let me find that really quick. But if you look back into the 2015 era, I just got to shut up and find it. Okay, there it is. Foundation articles.
Well, how do you feel about Bill Gates' avian, the Gates Foundation's avian vaccines? That's what's starting this bird flu. That's what started it in Africa. He was vaccinating the chickens in Africa, and then that's where the avian flu showed up. And then all of a sudden, millions of chickens are put down. Same thing with going on in the United States in the last few years, last few months, really.
Well, I have seen stories about avian influenza coming together here. To be quite honest, the correlation that you're drawing there is not one that I've even considered or an angle. So again, that's why I'm excited to talk to y'all. I know this is a super knowledgeable audience. If you don't mind, I promise you, I will find that report. I don't know which social media you have, but I'll post it for you if that works for you. But I'm also going to write that down for myself for later. Avian flu. Gates. I would say if you're wanting to find some spicy videos that you probably haven't seen from largely activist type groups that use they got the language down just right. They absolutely read him for everything he is and then some. And honestly, it's a lot of things that people don't know. Their work with Monsanto, it's infuriating. The fact that that's a conversation for a different time, but the farming systems and the seed ownership and the fact that farmers don't even own their own seeds and can't replant the seeds that come from their own damn plants. It's an absolute travesty and people don't even know. But I would say go back to those. But my files are a little bit, I have too many, man, but I like that you said that that's your turf. That's awesome. That's a good mindset.
It is.
I think one of my favorite videos of Bill Gates. Oh, sorry.
Well, you know, I'm not trying to boast, but the more you put yourself out there, the more ownership you have of your area. And so that's what we've been trying to do, is just encourage people to just take to the streets, not to be violent, but to literally just try to own your city, because, you know, you live here too. And if we don't, if we stop acquiescing our presence, then what are they can't do exactly what they're trying to do. They'll have to redirect. And it's a better tactic than going head on, getting arrested and demonizing an entire nation full of patriots. Way better to just do peaceful protests, just stand out there fearless and literally try to encourage people to think. Start thinking.
For sure.
You know, God bless you. And I can't wait
Thank
to see that
much.
Link. And thanks for your time. You're doing a great job on Harrison's show.
I'm nervous, but I'm having a blast. Thank you so much for calling in, man. It was awesome to talk to you, Tim. Go own your corner.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Catch you later. All right, fellas. Can we go to, I guess, Wild in Wisconsin. Wants to talk about my Israel commentary. That should be fun. What's up, Wild?
Hey, what's up, Lauren? You're doing a great job.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say thanks. I am Southern and I will ramble. What you got to say?
Oh, it's all right. It's cute that you're nervous. Since you're an online commentator and you were talking about spicy takes, given the situation we have with Israel, I was wondering, in relationship between Israel and its relationship with Russia and the U.S., what you think about Poles Razor. Have you ever heard of that, Poles Razor?
Can you spell that for me? Clearly no.
P-O-L-S, and then Razor, like Occam's Razor.
Okay. I will look it up real quick.
I can just beat it out for you. And basically it says, you know, if the Holocaust actually happened and the Allies really did save the Jewish people from evil gas chambers, Jewish people should be building monuments to their white rescuers and singing their praises. Instead, they write article after article, policy after policy about how all whites need to be sterilized and exterminated and replaced. They're ungrateful to their liberators. Men charge into machine gun fire to save them, and now they're telling the generations that came after that they all deserve to die for the crime of being white. Thus begs the following question. If the Holocaust was real and the Jewish people hate their liberators, doesn't that prove Hitler's points right about them? Or alternatively, if Jews feel free to attack their liberators and have no guilt in doing so, doesn't that prove the Holocaust never happened? I thought it was a pretty spicy take, and I don't know how to feel about it, given what's going on with World War III and now this giant kerfuffle with what's going on at the universities in the U.S. and the speech control and loyalty oath to Israel. What do you think?
Easy question. No, you know, those are big questions that I would be lying if I said I haven't given consideration to them, but I would also be lying if I said I had any sort of like definitive kind of ultimate thoughts on it currently.
The more
I learn, the more I realize I don't actually know anything, and not to completely divert to a different subject, but for example, one of the kind of cornerstones of American history that laid the foundations for the first hate crime bills was a incident that took place in 1998 in Laramie. You might remember it. It was when a homosexual young man named Matthew Shepard was supposedly beaten simply for just being gay, strung up on a fence and left to die. And then he did die. And then the subsequent legislation, the nonprofit his parents set up in his name, etc., all came forth, and that was really a cornerstone of it. And it turns out, retrospectively, about 15 years later, after like 300 interviews and really digging into it, that wasn't the narrative at all. But it was seized on so quickly by activist groups. So we actually talked about this on my show the other night. That's why it's kind of fresh in my brain. Within like 3 days, the Associated Press took up the official narrative that he was beaten to death simply for being gay. And they then started calling for the legislation. It rolled out and it was already done. Actually, just yesterday, some funding was made available on grants.gov, invoking the Matthew Shepard, Someone Bird Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act of, I believe, like 2001. These are still fundings that are perpetuated today, even though it's widely known now that was not the true story. But it's those original sin stories, the good versus evil, which side of history are you going to be on kind of stories. I don't know. Anytime I see those now, I question what motives were in place at the time and who was waiting to achieve the most with it. So I guess in a very roundabout way, I don't know, but I don't really count just about anything out anymore. But I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you aside from that.
I don't have a good answer either, but I think the best medicine is open debate. You know, I think these things need to be talked about. You know, and that's the best way and only way we're going to get through all of these problems is as a collective, as all of humanity together.
Well, and that's what they hate the most, though, is that people are talking about it. Yeah, they hate very, very much that people are able to talk about things. It's productive and it's healthy to have difficult conversations and to not lose your like head over it, you know. And I think one of the biggest mistakes ultimately that's ever been made in kind of the narrative war is in 2020, of course, because they were panicking about stories about COVID and about stories about the election being shared. They started mass banning everyone. That was such a mistake because people realized fundamentally that we needed alternatives to the big tech platforms. And really, we didn't, like, there weren't any. But now it doesn't really matter what ultimately becomes of YouTube or Twitter or Instagram or wherever, because we have platforms that are robust enough to withstand and to move to and really be pretty seamless about it. They really, really screwed up in 2020. It's one of my favorite things that they've ever done in a big mess up, is decide to start banning people. Because now they can't stand that they don't have backdoor access to the other social media platforms. So I don't know, just keep talking about it. You know, it's a good practice to be in, to talk about things that make you uncomfortable. So that's my life advice. You're welcome.
I'll let you get on to the next caller, but great points. I agree with you. You know, silencing and banning, you know, banning is silencing pretty much. It makes their voices louder. You have a happy Friday now, Lauren.
You too, Wild. Have a great day. All right, let's go to Simon in Florida. Has got a big topic. We got about 6 minutes left for this segment. Then we got a couple more after this. Simon in Florida wants to talk about the meeting of defense ministers from China and Iran. Let's go. What you got, Simon?
Hi there, Lauren. It's a pleasure to speak with you, maintaining my record of speaking with every single guest host that InfoWorld has on. The South Shanghai Cooperation Organization are meeting today and yesterday in Kazakhstan in Central Asia. And on the sidelines of the meeting, there's been a get-together between the Chinese and the Iranian defense ministers. And they've announced that they've agreed to, quote, much closer cooperation between the armed forces of Iran and the People's Republic of China. And I would suggest that has quite large implications for any course of action that Israel may be considering at this time. I'll be discussing this at much greater length on the podcast that I do with Sam Chaney at Weaponized News, 7 o'clock tonight. weaponizednews.com. But it does seem to be quite a serious issue that I think people need to pay attention to. The Iranians have also, at the meeting of BRICS, which is also...
Yeah, I was going to say they joined BRICS.
Mm-hmm. They joined BRICS, and just yesterday they have asked for all of the member nations of BRICS, so all 10 countries, take definitive action against Israel in order to bring about a peaceful conclusion of the activities in Gaza. So we're seeing, as the president of Iran suggested, activities that are beneficial to Iran, having achieved membership of both BRICS and SCO last year. So they're really having a diplomatic breakthrough. And obviously those are different groups of countries. So you've got Pakistan and the five members of Central Asia are actually in the SCO, which China is about to adopt the one-year chairmanship of. And that's a different group of countries, obviously, from BRICS, which includes South Africa and Brazil. So they're essentially building quite a large consortium. Some might say a coalition of the willing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I mean, can you blame them? No. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for
I'm not trying to be critical. Thought. I'm just trying to share the information with the audience. So thank you for
No, for sure. I knew that President Xi had spoken to Antony Blinken today, but I did not know about the rest. Thanks for bringing that. Thanks. That's awesome. And it was weaponized news for tonight.
Weaponized news every day, 7 p.m. Right. That's correct.
All right. Thank you very much for calling in, Simon.
Bye.
All right, cool. Leslie in Nevada, we got about 3 minutes left of this this part of the segment, but you say you want to talk about geoengineering in Las Vegas. You said you're literally cold right now. How cold is it?
Yes. It's about 60 degrees, which is unusual for this time of year and for this area. And the planes were out yesterday and last night and early this morning. I counted about 15. And these planes fly out of Reno. There's a company called DRI, Desert Research Institute. that is running the cloud seeding program here, but it's not just cloud seeding. They've been telling us in our newspapers that they're only doing cloud seeding, and that is an absolute lie, because this morning I have chickens, so I'm literally up with the chickens, right? Before sunrise?
Right.
Before sunrise, it was a normal temperature for this area for this time. The sun came up, and when the sun is
What is the usual temperature?
The usual temperature is about 55, 48. Cool. 48 is the low. Okay. 55 would be a high for the first thing in the morning. And
Sorry for interrupting you. Carry on.
No, that's good. Make me give you more details. So when the sun comes up, right as it's coming up over the mountain, it slips under that cloud layer, and you can feel the heat of the sun. And as soon as the sun rises up into the clouds, the temperature drops like 5-6 degrees instantly. The wind starts picking up, and with the wind chill, it gets even colder. And I'm still wearing silk underwear in the desert at this time. It is absolutely ridiculous. This time last year, I was scampering about in a bikini by this time of the day. The solar dimming project that they are doing here is so extreme here in the desert. And it's because of all the federal dollars that they get to that institute, DRI, Desert Research Institute. You're interested in cloud seeding. Right, and the geoengineering. Those are some major offenders. I have not exactly figured out.
To look at it.
Yeah, this is good for you.
Awesome.
It's good to talk to you, Lauren.
Find me on social media. Let's talk about this later. I'd love to.
Right on. We'll do. Okay, bye.
All right, cool. All right, everyone. If you want to, we've got quite a few people on the waiting, but if you want to call in, I'll be back. 1-877-789-2539. Taking calls. We're all talking about all manner of things. And again, one of the things that I was looking forward to the most of doing this guest host. Yeah, again, thanks for putting up with me here, is I love hearing what other people have to say. And I know that this is a very knowledgeable and very intelligent audience. And so I'm learning from y'all, and you're maybe learning from me. Who knows? You probably already know it already. So without further ado, let's see who we're going to go to next. I wanted to go down to Craig in Ohio. I wanted to talk about the financial side of today's story. I do like talking finance. So what you got for me, Craig?
Morning, Lauren.
Morning.
Morning. So I was glad to see you covering the IMF, World Bank, MasterCard, all that kind of stuff. I don't think that stuff gets covered enough because, what we have to remember is that this country is founded on, capitalism and, economic strength and financial stability, right? And that's what's given us a strong military, but don't forget the agricultural side too. But that's a whole different topic. But the biggest thing I think is, we were talking, just trying to bridge a couple of the stories today. You guys were talking about Bill Gates and, all the things he's into, right? The vaccines, the mosquitoes, the agricultural land, all this stuff,
dabbled
right?
In all
the
of
thing
it.
That,
yeah.
Yes. The thing that gets left out, though, is his relationship to Warren Buffett, right? His relationship to some of these other big power guys. So what people don't realize is, 6 or 8 years ago, Warren Buffett turned over all of his wealth at some point, when he dies, to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So these guys are funding all this stuff. So we think of Warren Buffett as this good guy, the avuncular, Warren Buffett that, can do no wrong. But the big thing that we have to do, I think, is keep calling this out. And that's what I was just calling to, pat you on the back today for covering this, because, people let their 401ks get turned over to BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, we could go down the whole list of all of them, right? Fidelity, right? All these people. And what they do is it's actually putting bullets in their, in their back pocket to use back against us, because they're taking our money, right, and using it on their pet projects, seeding the skies, buying up all this stuff, whatever they're doing, right? And they're turning around and using it on us. So I think, one thing that gets, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, but one of the things I don't think it's covered enough is the whole financial component, and then the responsibility that people have themselves to understand how that money that they've worked their life to save, that they hope is going to carry them through retirement and give to their kids and so forth, is being used in a proper way. Because if not, your kids and your grandkids aren't going to have a future, you know, if you let these people utilize your money to create big data centers, to, you know, that are tracking your every movement, right? Yeah, we could go on the list, but you get my point. So I just wanted to put that out there and get your thoughts on it.
Well, I think you're right. I think one of the things that kind of is unfortunate about it is people tend to tune out when it comes to financial things like this. Not necessarily this specific audience and community, which is wonderful, but you kind of have to get into the nitty gritty. And I honestly, when I was talking about it today, I don't know how well I conveyed some of it because I know what I know in my head and versus like, you know, so I hope at least some of it landed. I know you're absolutely correct. I think that one of the biggest kind of, oh dang, I was totally wrong about that moments was, again, highlighting that giving pledge, like you just said, Warren Buffett. I think it was like 10% of his shares of Berkshire Hathaway to the foundation's trust of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And honestly, one of the worst parts about 501c3 nonprofit foundations, by the way, for any of y'all who don't know, is that I think the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's current valuation of their 501c3 is like around $50 billion, give or take, you know. But they take the money that's in that trust and invest it in like long-term stocks and bonds in their friends' companies to continue to be able to fund the trust of their foundation. So they're just double dipping. It's the most sick, disgusting thing ever. And I don't know what the right answer is for this because, again, you know, I didn't make the smartest financial decisions in my 20s, you know, figuring it out now. So I do agree we need to talk about it. I don't know if I'm the one, though, but I do appreciate the pat on the back. That makes,
But I think it's good that you brought that up, right? You bring exposure to it, right? You know, any little bit that we can do so that people realize that, and that's all I wanted to do is make the connection to, you know, we have a responsibility to understand the financial side of it so that we're not, you know, it's kind of like they say, you know, chasing your tail or shooting yourself in the foot, right? You know, or, you know, if we don't know where that money that we've worked our whole lives for to save, if we don't know where it's going and how it's being used, then, you know, then we're doing just as much damage to our future because we're just putting it right back in their hands, right? And these people can pull the rug out from underneath us in a second. Like, you think your 401k is safe and you're like, well, that's okay. I'm just going to ride along with, you know, I might as well ride along with the villains because, you know, that's the wrong attitude because they can pull the rug out on this market from us in a second, you know. So,
they can manipulate the market to their will.
Yeah, we've seen it multiple times. You know, I've traded. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to make a really dumb joke. Don't encourage me. Carry on.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say, you know, people just, you know, whatever you can do to learn more about the financial side, right, and also take more responsibility for it, I think, that, you know, the better off you're going to feel, the better you're going to feel about it, you know, and the more control that you're going to take out of their hands. Every penny that you take out of their hands is a penny they don't have to use against you. You know, just keep that in mind, right?
Just print more pennies, man. Isn't that the whole thing? Just print more money.
Well,
easy. I don't have the right answers, but you know, the first step is talking about it, I guess. So thanks very much. And yeah, cool. that's all I got. I can get probably one more before we go into the next 10 minutes. And I guess the show's over. Thanks for sticking with me this time. All right. So Eric in Kentucky says Bill Gates discussing triggered a couple things. Hi, Eric in Kentucky. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing good. I'm one of your Rumble fans.
Hi.
I saw a little email from you, and I said, Al's on Paris the show.
I think I know it's Eric then. Hi.
Yeah, Eric DeGray from Kentucky. I've harassed you on your Rumble thing. As far as Bill Gates, I think RFK Jr. has got the best package of information on him in the Fauci book.
Oh, for sure.
And how the Gates Foundation looks at Africa is it's a vaccine testing guinea pig source.
Mm-hmm.
And his thing with Kenya and the tetanus vaccine to sterilize people. That was a fun experiment they did. And they're not worried about things like clean water or like feeding people. They're just, we need to test this vaccine. So, hey, would you like to sign up for a digital currency on your phone so we can automatically register for you to do a vaccine trial when those become available? That's how I think they look at us, or how they look at Africa. I'm always suspicious of that bunch.
It's a testing grounds for things that ultimately, again, these are people who claim to know, they know what's best for the entire world. If you're not familiar, I'm sure you are, but a lot of people don't know about the Good Club, which was an organization that as soon as people started writing about it, they never really talked about it again, but the Good Club was a group of people like Bill Gates and I think it's like Ted Turner and Oprah Winfrey or whatever. They, if you look it up, they all got together. And again, it was like the Chatham style discussion where it doesn't leave this room. But again, they love getting together and deciding what's best for the whole world. And they're just, they're so full of their own ego that they truly believe that that's like their destiny. And it's sickening. So. I don't know. Thanks for calling. I'll catch y'all here in like, I don't know, a minute. Well, I have had an absolute blast guest hosting for Mr. Harrison Smith today. I can't thank y'all enough for your calls and for just listening. We've got about 10 and a half minutes left. And before we go, I want to take a couple more calls, but I need to make a confession to y'all. And it's that I have an energy drink problem, and there is a solution for that if you have an energy drink problem. And wouldn't you believe it, is that you can take your focus and your mental clarity to the next level, because at InfoWarsStore.com, Rainforest Ultra is 40% off. Stop getting your energy from toxic sources. Many energy drinks and other products are loaded with artificial ingredients. Rainforest Ultra is a serious source of real energy you can feel good about taking every day. It has more than twice the servings and even a stronger proprietary super formula than the original Brainforce Plus formula. It is packed with powerhouse ingredients like guarana seed, alpha GPC, green coffee bean, Eleuthero root. I'm going to have to look that one up. Yerba mate leaf, green tea leaves, ginkgo leaf, and ashwagandha. So support yourself and InfoWar. Get Brainforce Ultra today for 40% off before it's all gone. I genuinely might order some, because I wasn't kidding about that Red Bull addiction. So again, InfoWarsStore.com, 40% off Brainforce Ultra. Please do it so they'll invite me back. All right, cool. Wait, what else can I say? Don't drink Red Bull. It's bad for you. All right. I got a couple more. We have about 8 minutes left. I want to go to Got Your Number 444 on X, who says, I was suspended on X after less than a month. I can relate to that. I'm like on account number 20. What happened today? What'd you do?
Well, actually, it was like on the 22nd of April, I believe. I began like on the 3rd of April and just was sharing different thoughts and questions about, you know, my perspective on the mess the world is in, and nothing was really critical on my actual page. I literally only have 7 posts, and I did critique Ben Shapiro, Flint Dibble, and Rabbi Shmuley directly, like, and saying that they all obviously have narratives that they follow. Like, they live in, like, we're all familiar with Plato's cave allegory, and, you know, also Shakespeare's being canceled right now, I think, because honestly, you know, Shakespeare said all the world is a stage and its peoples in it are actors, and we're all talking about bad actors. And what I realized is that by implication it's saying we're all actors, that we must be on that stage. But I think the power of that statement is to realize that you can be a part of the audience and watch people. And what I realized is, like, we're all so afraid of this World War III, this mess that we feel like we're already in. And I've been considering, you know, history is only history because we continually make the same mistakes. And also, you can never force a change, but only show a better way. And I've also recently realized and know that there's this study about, like, how traffic has a memory. And if you follow too close, that's how you get those 70 and 80, you know, car pileups. So the only way that we can avoid that, if we have sense, is leave some space for others, right? So if we all just follow these stories that we've all been raised with, because I live here in the Bible Belt, and I promise you that I love God, the source, energy, universe, whatever you want to call it, that energy that's in us all. You know, chi is just a colloquialism for a soul. Prana is just another colloquialism for a soul. But we want to believe that the church we went to, the traditions we have, is like the only way. And like with Israel and Hamas, we don't have to pick a side. We can step back from it and see it's a mess. And if any two people conspire, you know, kill someone, that, well, that's murder. That's a crime. And with these wars, we're sitting back and not watching two people conspire to create murder, but a whole, well, a small group of a few are lying and all the rest of us are dying. And we need to leave space for one another and realize that, like, these people that are in power that we all see, like, they've been organizing all of this and leading us into these cages, the cave, Plato's allegory. I know that I have friends I've recently met from Lebanon. They're Orthodox. Some of the people I grew up around would think that they're wrong just because they're Orthodox Christians. And I've seen one church on one corner act like they're better than the other. We're all looking for that same truth and that same connection, and we need to stop forcing, like, our connections and our experience on others. Please don't yell.
Sure.
And that's the kind of stuff that
it's
I was
Friday.
Posting.
Let him yell.
And, like, we, and I,
boys, calm down.
And it was just things like that. But I did, that morning, the last thing I posted was a critique on the Flint Dibble, the archaeologist who, again, they bought into academia's Clovis First and all that. We're all realizing there's more. I mean, you know, they hide everything. They're never forthcoming, just like with the bridge. You know, they're not forthcoming. They want to sow fear and doubt, and they always tell us the horrible details, but not the ones we're asking for in the moment when we can do a thing about it. And as far as, like, I just, the AIPAC thing, like, if Russia putting, like, stories on social media is interfering, how does AIPAC get a pass? You know, like, they're obviously interfering directly. And, you know, I don't understand basic things like that. And picking a side between Israel and Hamas literally is like, if we as a nation picked a side between the Hatfield and McCoys and then said, well, this side is always right, always going to be right, and they get emergency powers and they get to force their narrative on everybody, even the people in our country. And I don't understand that coalition. I understand leaving space for people to express and get exposure to God in different ways. That's how we develop a picture. We have to get exposure. But I don't understand why we have to pretend like someone – one group has a monopoly on God, because that's the same puzzle, same picture we're all trying to get exposure for.
Well, because we got about 3 minutes left here, I will leave you with this. I think that one of the most powerful things you can do in a world that all the world's a stage is to not be a spectator and not be an actor either. They obviously want to coerce and coax out of you the canned responses, the they say this so you say that, until you can basically predict your very next move. I think just moving outside of it and actually just saying what's actually on your mind or exactly what you think is a really powerful practice to make. But also, as far as Israel goes, if you're not familiar already, I believe it's israelbonds.com. hang on, let me make sure what this is really quick. War, it makes a lot of money. If you go to israelbonds.com, you can actually kind of start going down this rabbit hole. I think there's something like 14 states within the United States have invested no insignificant amount of money in buying war bonds from Israel, which they will benefit from financially significantly should there be a good outcome for Israel. So it's not... there's so many different facets and aspects to it. And again, I don't pretend to have it all figured out, but the war bond thing is now you have the success of Israel will determine the financial health of like 14 some odd states. And I bet you can guess which ones some of them are. So Israel, yeah, it's israelbonds.com. I can probably take like one more, but then we got to get out of here. Jeff and NC, you got like a minute and a half. Do you want to say something? You got like just a second.
I'd love to. Go Auburn, War Eagles. So I've been listening to you like back since like I got deplatformed in 2015. You had a YouTube channel back then. And it's really cool to see. I've seen you over with Peter Duke and George Webb. And this morning, like when I saw you, I was like, man, this is amazing because they have yesterday they had a whistleblower on like with about Joe Biden. I don't really want to talk about him too much because I just
Well, we got like 30 seconds left, you can't talk about much of anything. It's wild for me too, man.
You're doing a great job, and And if nobody's told you that they love you today, I love you, buddy. You have a great weekend. Okay.
I love you too, man. It's unbelievable. This wasn't the plan, but I'm so grateful that I'm just grateful. I genuinely am. I'm happy to have gotten the chance to talk to y'all today about the things that I'm thinking about. Good to talk to you, Jeff. Find you on social media somewhere. But since we got about 30 seconds left, y'all, thank you so much for watching American Journal today. Thank you for calling in and talking. If I didn't get to you, I'm so sorry. You can find me at bigdigenergy.info or some B I know on Twitter. You can figure it out. I have the links on my site. We talk about this kind of stuff during my show. I love coming on and talking to Harrison. Thanks to the producers at American Journal. They do a lot of heavy lifting and put up with my nonsense. Y'all are the best. I'll see ya next time.